place at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. This Triangle production will run from November 29th through December 22nd. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:01 p.m. This is KBOO FM Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News, which has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the budget passed the House and will head to the Senate for likely passage, thereby avoiding another government shutdown.
An economic study indicates that the Northwest's only nuclear power plant is so costly it might need to be shut down.
Protesters in Thailand call for the ousting of the Prime Minister as she dissolves Parliament.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 13th, 2013. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. The Oregon Health Authority recently changed an obscure policy requiring that Medicaid recipients between the ages of 55 and 65 pay for their care. KBOO's Christian Danielson has more.
Since its launch on October 1st, Oregon has been criticized for the troubled rollout of its health insurance marketplace, Cover Oregon. But the state has received praise for successfully signing up thousands of newly or unknowingly eligible Oregonians for the state's Medicaid program, known more commonly as the Oregon Health Plan. Some background. Medicaid is a health insurance program for people with low incomes that is run and financed jointly by the federal and state governments. States run their Medicaid programs differently, but benefits like doctor's visits and hospitalization are usually provided at very low or even no cost to the recipient. Before the Affordable Care Act was passed by the federal government in 2010, being eligible for Medicaid generally meant having income below the poverty line and having very few assets other than a home. The law gave states federal funding to raise the Medicaid income limit and eliminated the asset test, making millions of people eligible for Medicaid coverage if their state opted to take the money. But for new enrollees who are 55 or older, the coverage can come with a serious drawback, a policy known as Medicaid Estate Recovery. Since 1993, the federal government has required each state to claw back money spent on Medicaid recipients older than 54 by making claims on their estates after their death. Journalist Beverly Woods began looking into Medicaid estate recovery several years ago when her home state of New Hampshire said they planned to put a lien on her elderly mother's home for the costs she'd incurred while on the state's Medicaid program. She found that her state's bureaucracy and others have sometimes applied their laws inconsistently.
In our state, I had seen that there was, in fact, a law that said that you couldn't kick the surviving spouse out of residence, and yet New Hampshire Medicaid did exactly that until there was a class action lawsuit by half a dozen widows saying, don't do this, don't throw us out. And they won the lawsuit with the assistance of New Hampshire legal assistance. The policies under which they operate are not well known, are not written down. They don't have to make their meetings public. They don't have to make their policies public. And so it's a bunch of unknowns when you're going into Medicaid estate recovery.
While states must attempt to recover the costs of long-term services like nursing home care, they can also choose to pursue 100% of any Medicaid expenditures on elderly beneficiaries, including preventative care, prescriptions, and even premiums paid on their behalf. Until last month, Oregon had a reputation for an aggressive Medicaid estate recovery policy. The state pursued all its costs for Oregon Health Plan beneficiaries older than 54 and defines the term estate broadly, allowing it to pursue assets that might be sheltered or excluded in other states. But on November 25th, the Oregon Health Authority released an announcement saying the state would no longer pursue Oregon Health Plan expenditures. The state plans to only pursue the federally required long-term health care costs, which are administered by a different state program. According to Oregon Medicaid Director Judy Moore Peterson, the rule change came in response to agency feedback.
We have taken a look at that, what the, both the federal, the minimum federal requirements are, as well as what the new requirements are for having health insurance and access to health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, and realized that the estate recovery as we had it envisioned, including if they were receiving no other benefits other than the Oregon Health Plan, were actually preventing individuals from signing up because they were afraid of losing their house or their other assets. We didn't want to have that kind of barrier in the way.
Moore Peterson also said the state's interest in getting as many people covered as possible and taking advantage of federal dollars ultimately outweighed an interest in pursuing reimbursement for standard care.
And the other thing to keep in mind is that these individuals, would they not be covered under the Medicaid program, would actually be uninsured. And that actually has a variety of costs that impact our state in general. They impact the hospitals. They impact the local communities. So we believe overall as a state that getting these individuals coverage will be the great option and the healthy option for our state.
While the rule change is administrative and has not been codified by law, Moore Peterson said she saw the chance of it being reversed as very unlikely. While Oregon is scaling back its estate recovery program, older residents in other states may be putting their assets at long-term risk if they elect to sign up for Medicaid. As Woods argues, people with too much income for Medicaid will receive no-strings-attached subsidies to buy private insurance, a policy she describes as fundamentally unfair.
I really think that we need to have a far more public national conversation about how we treat people who are on Medicaid and why it's okay to go and collect the assets of people who qualify for Medicaid, but not the assets of people who qualify for subsidies, and whether this is really a good policy if we actually want to have less poverty in this country. Should we be removing these assets from these people? I think that's a debate that we need to have.
For KBOO News in Portland, Oregon, I'm Christian Danielson.
Yesterday, the Machinists Union rejected Boeing's final proposal on a contract with its workers in the Puget Sound area to build the 777X airplane. The district union president stated that the conditions were too similar to a proposal the union shot down a month ago. One of the contentious issues that Boeing was not willing to budge on was the change in contract to establish 401k retirement plans for its employees rather than the current pension plan. Although the union has not endorsed the proposal, union members will still have the opportunity to vote on the matter. A no vote is expected. Potential consequences of this action could be that Boeing will move its operations elsewhere, thereby taking with it well over 1,000 jobs. In fact, it has already received requests from 22 states to construct the airplanes in these different locations. The 777X airliner will hold 400 people and is designed to be more fuel efficient than the current 777 airplane.
A spate of recent demolitions in the East Moreland neighborhood has got homeowners up in arms. In the past year, over 230 homes in Portland have been approved for demolition, up by 40% from 2011. In addition, almost 3,000 homes have been approved for remodel, and the line between a remodel and a demolition can be hazy, as residents are finding out. A remodel requires no notifications, and through a recent loophole, even a demolition project does not necessarily have to warn neighbors. Keegan Heron spoke with Robert McCulloch, president of the East Moreland Neighborhood Association, for more.
Why have developers been able to demolish homes without giving neighbors prior notice?
Portland, Oregon has been a leader in land use planning and livability for many years. However, sometime, probably within the last decade, a very fine lobbyist, so fine that we've not been able to find out when he had the law changed or why, inserted Amendment K-1 into the city's statutes. And K-1 is basically the passing lane for development. If you go get your permit for demolition and your permit for construction on the same day, you can ignore all the other rules. Now, obviously, once we figured this out, we were horrified. How could we eliminate, like, 50 years of good planning in one astonishingly undocumented amendment? And yet, there it is. So, if you wake up tomorrow morning with a bulldozer driving through your neighbor's house, that's perfectly fine. Now, you may be pretty upset because this is Portland. A lot of our homes were built between the 30s and the 50s, and they have asbestos in them. When demolished, they release the asbestos into the atmosphere. Under the law, they're supposed to check for it and abate it. But, of course, now that they can do instantaneous demolition, there's no time to check for it, and there's no way for an official to go supervise. So if you do hear that bulldozer, grab your kids and your great aunt and get the hell out of Dodge. Now, literally, this sounds like an exaggeration until you review what happened this month at Knapp and 39th. Small home, right next to a Catholic school, knocked down. We still don't know whether he checked for asbestos. We believe he did not. When we finally arrived, there was a bulldozer driving through the house and knocking the trees down. We called the city and said, they're knocking the trees down. The city said, well, they couldn't do that without a permit. Well, how would you know he had a permit? So we're literally sitting there seeing the bulldozer topple the trees. As far as we know, no permits. And this, of course, is the very green Oregon where you can just buy a bulldozer and knock down any trees you want. So we were horrified. And we were, of course, horrified because many of the neighborhood's children go to that grade school, and we would not want them exposed to asbestos.
So is this a recent phenomenon?
The Oregonian reporter, Melissa Binder, has done a lot of research on it. She's recently published an article on this, and you can just see this rocket increase in demolitions in Southeast over the last few years. So the moment that you found out about this exception to all of the land use rules, there's no reason not to take advantage of it. It's an incredible incentive to go ahead, literally we call this a hit-and-run demolition, to just go right ahead, do it, avoid any regulatory entanglement with the environmental authorities or the city forester or any of the planning process. And when the neighbors wake up the next day, it's simply an empty lot.
So what is the East Moreland Neighborhood Association doing to address this problem?
Well, a variety of things. Number one, we have a very active land use group. We're active at the city. They are working on the comprehensive plan. And they're also proposing a zoning change for our neighborhood to protect us. Number two, we are waiting like vultures for the right case, and then we're going to litigate. And the right case involves someone not checking, us getting there at the right moment, so that we can document all the abuses, and then we're going to actually file a land use action on this. And unfortunately, we have to be faster than the developer, which means if he starts knocking things down at 5 in the morning, we're going to have to be there at 5 in the morning to take a roll.
Now, has this been happening in other neighborhoods as well?
Yes, I believe it's occurring across Portland. This K1 exemption applies to the entire city of Portland. It really doesn't matter if you live on Hawthorne or up on Killingsworth or even across the river. If someone wants to demolish the house next to you, they don't have to give you any notice. And they certainly don't have to wait while you take your children and any elderly people in the house to safety.
Wow. Well, Robert, thank you very much for educating our listeners.
Can I make one request? Would you call Amanda Fritz often and repeatedly on this issue? Because we need her help.
I've been speaking with Robert McCullough of the East Moreland Neighborhood Association. This is Keegan Heron with KBOO News.
There is, however, an exception to the rule. If a property owner applies and pays for a new building permit at the same time as the demolition permit, that notification requirement can be waived.
Dozens of students at Wilson High School here in Portland led a walkout this morning. As members of the Portland Student Union, the students stood their ground outside the school to protest the impasse between the Portland Association of Teachers and the Portland Public School District. The effort was spawned to draw attention to a current proposal titled "The Schools Portland Students Deserve." This proposal emphasizes basic educational fundamentals. Points of interest include reducing class size, providing more electives, and offering more assessment tools than just standardized testing. Soon after the event, pictures of students holding signs began to flourish on social media. School principal Brian Chattard had already opposed the action in a previous email statement released to parents and students, deeming it unacceptable for students to vacate the school during instructional time. Students who chose to participate were to be marked absent, despite strong support from both teachers and their parents.
A report commissioned by the Oregon and Washington chapters of Physicians for Social Responsibility, or PSR, says that the Columbia Generating Station, the only remaining nuclear plant in the Pacific Northwest, is so costly it might make sense for it to be shut down. The plant produces around 1,000 megawatts, or 4% of the Pacific Northwest's electricity. An economic analysis performed by Portland's McCulloch Research found that closing the plant could save ratepayers almost $2 billion over the next 17 years. Also, two reports were released earlier this year by Terry Tolan, an engineering geologist based in Kennewick, Washington, detailing how the plant's design is based on an incomplete understanding of the area's vulnerability to earthquakes. The plant's design is similar to that of Japan's Fukushima reactor, and an earthquake near the Columbia Generating Station could cause a similar catastrophe. KBOO's Ryan Katz spoke with Robert McCullough with Physicians for Human Rights.
Can you give me some background on the Columbia Generating Station?
Well, the Columbia Generating Station nuclear plant is a GE boiling water reactor of similar design to the Fukushima plants in Japan. And it was one of five nuclear plants that the Washington Public Power Supply System, also known as WPPSS, W-P-P-S-S, a consortium of publicly owned utilities, attempted to build in the 1970s and 80s. And it was the only one of the five that was completed. It used to be known as WPPSS 2, but now is known as the Columbia Generating Station, and it was completed in 1984. It's been operating ever since. A lot of people don't even know we still have an operating nuclear power plant in the Northwest, but we do. It's on the Hanford Nuclear Reservation.
So what do its proponents say are the benefits of having a nuclear plant in Washington State?
Well, they believe that firm power is a really important thing to have. Wind, for example, picks up and levels off, and you have to somehow balance it out. Unfortunately, nuclear is not a good way to balance variable power like wind, because for the nuclear plant, you can't, on short notice, turn it down and or turn it back up. They're not 100% reliable, and they don't go 24/7. even when they're run perfectly, they need to shut down every 2 years for about a month and a half to refuel and do repair work. So you have to plan those outages, and you have to make plans for replacing that power during that during those time periods as well.
Right. So getting back to the report, what are the main conclusions of the McCullough report?
The main conclusions are that since 2009, the Columbia Generating Station nuclear plant has been uneconomic compared to buying power on the market. The Northwest, since the recession, has had a glut of power resources on the market. We've actually had negative growth in terms of our electric power use. And so what's ended up happening is that because of the cheap natural gas that's available for running gas turbines, and because of the growth of wind, and it's so inexpensive to run wind once it's built, power has been available that could have been bought to replace this plant.
Why are the costs at Columbia Generating Station so high, and who ultimately bears the brunt for that issue?
The costs are high because nuclear power plants, as they age, begin to have their costs creep up because you have repairs that you need to make. The Columbia Generating Station had a major repair of its condenser, which was failing. They had to replace it in 2011. When you shut it down, and they had to shut the plant down for 6 months at that point, it increases the cost of the power because nuclear power has to operate all the time in order to even be close to being economic. The costs at this nuclear plant happen to be significantly higher than most comparable plants.
So you mentioned earlier that the plant was manufactured with the same technology as the Fukushima power plant. Is this plant at risk for a Fukushima-style disaster?
Yes. It is a GE boiling water reactor of with a Mark II containment, which is not the same as the Mark I containments that had problems in Fukushima, but it has the same basic design flaws, which is a long and narrow containment structure that is smaller than what they've now determined is a better design and more easy to overwhelm in an accident where you lose water cooling to the core, which is what happened in Japan. There are plans in place that aren't being implemented immediately, which we believe they should be if you're serious about the safety. You can't organize when an accident's going to occur, and waiting until 2019 to put in a vent doesn't make sense at all. But if you're going to do it, you should do it right away.
Right. So what are the recommendations of the McCullough report, and what can be done going forward?
The McCullough report recommends that the plant be closed in 2015 when it is up for refueling. He actually says that the logical time to do it from a utility standpoint would be when they're refueling and you're about to incur a large expense anyway. Our position is, because of safety concerns, we believe the plant should be closed right away and the power should be sought on the market, regardless of when the best time an economist thinks should be done.
Right. So if the plant was closed, how much would taxpayers save?
Well, first off, people should know that if it were closed, it provides about 10% of the electricity that's provided by Bonneville, which is around 4% of the electricity that people in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana use. So it's a large amount, but it's not insurmountable to replace it at all, particularly given the power glut that we currently have. The savings would be there somewhere between $100 and $200 million annually, which works out to up to $50 a person in the Northwest for people who purchase Bonneville Power.
And for more information about this topic, you can go to their website at psr.org. This has been Ryan Katz with KBOO News.
The Arctic 30 Greenpeace protesters received a letter dashing hopes that they would be released out of Russia. The Russian government declared that the group is to stay in St. Petersburg over the winter until their trial. The Arctic 30 were arrested in mid-September for occupying an offshore oil rig in the Arctic Ocean off the coast of Russia. Imprisoned for 2 months, the crew was unexpectedly released out on bail last month. But Russia has refused to bow to international pressure to let the protesters leave the country, choosing instead to hold and charge them on counts of hooliganism. Thursday's letter reinforced this view, negating some senior Russian officials' attempts to grant the protesters exit visas. This comes on the heels of the Russian Supreme Court announcing that it would reassess the guilty verdict that was given to the Pussy Riot punk singers who have been in jail since the year 2012.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin after the newscast, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight's guests include author Sherry Goetz and nonprofit professional Sarah Reynolds, who will be discussing how to navigate through life's many changes as the new year approaches. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. This weekend's weather forecast calls for cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain. Highs will be in the mid to low 40s, with lows dipping into the mid 30s at nights. The moon is a waxing gibbous moon. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 33 counts per minute in North Portland, a high of 55. In Raleigh Hills, it's 30 CPM with a high of 49. Damascus, Oregon has a count of 32 CPM, a high of 52. Powell Butte measures 26 CPM with a high of 46. Vancouver, BC has a 39 CPM, high of 64. And Sitka, Alaska has a radiation count of 35 counts per minute with spikes of up to 55. EPA alerts levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
And now, a report on some upcoming seasonal events here in Portland. They include a crafty wonderland at the Oregon Convention Center this weekend. Over 250 vendors from across the nation will be showcasing handmade crafts, while the nonprofit SCRAP will be hosting an alternative gift wrapping workshop and free craft projects. The exhibition will be held from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. on both Saturday and Sunday. The Christmas Fleet will be up and running at night this weekend on the Willamette River with over 50 boats. They'll be decorated with Christmas lights as they make their way up and down the river. Also this weekend, the Zoo Lights will be on and the Grotto's Festival of Lights will be up and running.
Right-wing political operatives deserve credit for inventiveness. In particular, they've created the ROB defense for public officials who get caught engaging in bad personal behavior, such as sexual misconduct, snorting cocaine, and bribery. When nabbed in an act of naughtiness, the standard defense thrown out by politicians of all stripes has been to blame, quote, stress of overwork, and to apologize to anyone who is offended by their grossly offensive action. But that excuse is overused, so advisors to right-wing bad boys have invented a new defense, just claimed to have been in a drunken stupor at the time. So see, it really wasn't their fault. Blame the booze. The ROB defense is named for Rob Ford, the almost comically offensive mayor of Toronto, who keeps explaining that his crack cocaine use, abusive rages, and other antics only happen when he's sozzled, totally blotto. Recently, though, a Tea Party Congress critter from Florida added a clever refinement to the ROB. Arrested in November for buying cocaine, Representative Trey Radell dolefully confided in a press release that, quote, I struggle with the disease of alcoholism. That's a shrewd touch, for you get extra public sympathy if you're a victim of disease. But let's note that Trey also suffers from another disease he did not mention, political hypocrisyitis. Barely a month earlier, Radell had joined his Republican colleagues to bash poor people by voting to require mandatory drug tests for all welfare recipients. Did alcoholism make him do that, too? This is Jim Hightower saying, the poverty program pays under $200 a month for a family of four, while Ray Dell draws more than $14,000 a month from us taxpayers. If Congress really wants to kick drug abusers off the public dole, its best odds of finding some would be to start testing its own members. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
The bipartisan budget bill that passed yesterday in the House appears headed for passage in the Senate. Senate supporters will need 60 votes to advance the bill, and even some opponents believe passage is likely next week. While the budget delivers a net deficit reduction of $23 billion through the year 2023, critics argue that the spending increases come first and many of the cuts come later, if at all. Before yesterday's vote, Speaker John Boehner unleashed a stinging attack on Tea Party groups for opposing the bill. He said they lacked credibility and blamed them for leading the party into the government shutdown last fall. Of the representatives from Oregon and Washington, only Peter DeFazio of Eugene and Kurt Schrader of Salem broke with their party's leaders by voting against the bill. Although a budget deal has passed, there's still another fight coming up early next year over the debt ceiling. That fight, which will come right before the primaries, means that the fiscal battles haven't gone away but will likely heat up. Republican members of Congress may need to show how conservative they are to voters back home. If so, this deal could provide a temporary retreat for both parties in order to rest up for the coming battle over the debt ceiling.
The NSA is defending its stance on bulk data collection of information belonging to American citizens. Collecting data over a widespread margin without a court order has brought the NSA under public scrutiny over recent months. NSA Director General Keith Alexander is defending the position that information collected saves lives. He was quoted in a Senate oversight panel last Wednesday saying, "There is no other way we know of to connect the dots." General Alexander, Deputy Attorney General James Coles, and top intelligence lawyer Robert Litt reject a bill backed by Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy that would damper data